Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Professor Nancy Fraser of the New School for Social Research delivered the 2009 Storrs Lecture at Yale Law School. Her second lecture is entitled Predatory Protections and Dangerous Liaisons, an ambivalence of emancipation in the context of capitalist crisis. This lecture was delivered on Tuesday, October 6, 2009.
Okay, so I appreciate that there are people who were here yesterday and people who were not, so there's going to be a little bit of recapping, not too much, I hope, to be tedious for the repeaters. The thought of Karl Polanyi represents a promising resource for those who seek to understand the current crisis of capitalist society. The story told in his 1944 book, The Great Transformation, has strong echoes in current developments. That book traced a previous iteration of capitalist crisis to 19th century British efforts to engineer an impossible mythical creature, the so-called self-regulating market. That aspiration, inherently self-undermining and unrealizable, drove developments so deeply destructive of human society as to spark an ongoing counter-movement for the latter's protection. It was this double movement, as Polanyi called it, namely unregulated marketization followed by demands for social protection, that led, in Polanyi's view, to a century and a half of capitalist crisis, culminating in fascism and the Second World War. Now, this narrative is oddly familiar. There is at least a prima facie case for the view that the present crisis of capitalism has its roots in recent efforts to disencumber markets from the regulatory regimes, both national and international, established in the aftermath of World War II. What we today call neoliberalism is nothing but the second coming of the very same 19th century faith in the self-regulating market that unleashed the capitalist crisis Polanyi chronicled. Now, as then, attempts to implement that creed are rending social bonds, destroying livelihoods, and despoiling nature. Now, as then, counterforces are mobilizing to halt these depredations. On its face, then, today's crisis is plausibly viewed as a great transformation redux. It would be difficult, accordingly, to find a better starting point than Karl Polanyi for conceptualizing the present crisis. And yet, as I argued yesterday, his narrative is deeply flawed. Focused single-mindedly on harms emanating from disembedded markets, he overlooks harms originating elsewhere in the surrounding society. Occulting non-market-based forms of injustice, he also tends to whitewash forms of social protection that are at the same time vehicles of oppression. Focused overwhelmingly on struggles against market-based depredation, his narrative neglects struggles against injustices rooted in society and encoded in social protections. Thus, those who would utilize Polanyi today need to revise his framework. The goal should be a new quasi-Polanyian conception of capitalist crisis that avoids romanticizing society. Now, that was my aim in yesterday's lecture. Seeking to develop a critique that comprehends society as well as economy, I proposed to broaden Polanyi's problematic to encompass a third axis of social struggle that cross-cuts his central conflict between marketization and social protection. The third axis, which I named emancipation, aims to overcome forms of subjection rooted in society. Central to both iterations of the Great Transformation, the one analyzed by Polanyi and the one we are living through now, struggles for emancipation constitute the missing third that mediates every conflict between marketization and social protection. The effect of introducing this missing third was to transform his double movement into a triple movement. Now, the triple movement conceptualizes capitalist crisis as a three-sided conflict among advocates of marketization, advocates of social protection, and advocates of emancipation. In our time, each of these three orientations has ardent exponents. Marketization is fervently championed by neoliberals. Social protection commands support in various forms, from social democratic and trade union nationalists, from neo-traditional religious movements, from globalization activists, environmentalists, and indigenous peoples. Emancipation fires the passions of various successors to the new social movements, including multiculturalists, international feminists, gay and lesbian liberationists, cosmopolitan Democrats, human rights activists, and proponents of global justice. It is the complex relations among these three types of projects that impresses the shape of a triple movement on the present crisis of capitalist society. So in general, then, I suggested yesterday that the triple movement forms the core of a new quasi-Polanyian perspective that can clarify capitalist crisis in the 21st century. Having elaborated this perspective in yesterday's lecture, I propose to use it today to analyze contemporary developments. Now, I want to begin by explicating the historical schema that underlines Polanyi's framework. Subtending his idea of the double movement is a three-stage periodization. In the first stage, markets are embedded via society with the aid of the state. In the second, commercial classes use state power to disembed markets from the arrangements that had previously embedded them, thereby initiating the prolonged period of upheaval and crisis. In the third stage, society recaptures state power and uses it to re-embed markets in a more emphatically state-led way via a politically elaborated regime of regulation, which thereby resolves the crisis. So in this schema, the movement from stage one to stage two represents the first disembedding prong of the double movement, while that from stage two to stage three represents the second re-embedding prong. In the great transformation recounted by Polanyi, stage one was the mercantilist period which preceded the British Industrial Revolution. Stage two was the period of laissez-faire, which ran roughly from the late 1830s through the Second World War, with a brief interruption in the 1930s. Stage three was the post-war era that Polanyi anticipated and hoped to influence. For him, of course, the goal was a new democratic regulatory regime that would re-embed markets. Now, what Polanyi could not have anticipated is that his schema would lend itself to subsequent developments equally well. In our time, a second great transformation is underway, whose trajectory echoes the one he recounted. In our case, stage one, which ran from the end of the war to the 1970s, was the era of so-called embedded liberalism, encompassing the Keynesian welfare states of the first world and, to a lesser degree, the developmental states of the third, both underpinned by the international regulatory framework known as Bretton Woods. Stage two, which ran from the 1980s to the present, was, or maybe still is, the era of neoliberalism, which promoted the dismantling of the previous arrangements and the renewed disembedding of markets, thereby provoking the most severe capitalist crisis since the Great Depression. Stage three, if it comes to pass, will be the post-neoliberal era that we anticipate and hope to influence. For us, too, the goal should be a new wave of democratic political re-embedding, stabilized by a global regime of economic regulation. Economic and political and legal regulation, I should say. For us, however, protection must be rethought in the light of emancipation. Our task is to envision arrangements for re-embedding markets that serve simultaneously to Overcome Oppression. Now, today's lecture aims to contribute to this project. Although it builds directly on yesterday's lecture, it shifts the focus in four respects. In yesterday's lecture, I used the figure of the triple movement, of course, to reinterpret the great transformation that Polanyi analyzed, whereas today I use that figure to analyze our great transformation of the 21st century. In yesterday's lecture, I stressed the uses of the triple movement for critical theory. Today, in contrast, I look rather at what that figure can do for social actors and political movements. In yesterday's lecture also, I concentrated on developing the normative theoretical basis of the triple movement with reference to the norm of participatory parity. Today, in contrast, I develop some of its social institutional aspects. In yesterday's lecture, finally, I stressed the need to view conflicts between deregulation and social protection as mediated by emancipation, a mediation Polanyi neglected. Today, in contrast, I'll stress the need to view conflicts between protection and emancipation as mediated by marketization, a mediation that has been neglected by many emancipatory movements in the post-war era. Now, this last point is worth spelling out. As I explained in yesterday's lecture, the triple movement is a mediating device. Its core premise is that the relation between any two sides of a three-sided conflict must be mediated by the third. To neglect the third is to misunderstand the other two, the nature of their conflict, and the larger configuration in which that conflict is situated. So, because he neglected emancipation, Polanyi misunderstood the conflict between marketization and social protection. Specifically, he failed to appreciate that social protection is often ambivalent, affording relief from the disintegrative effects of deregulation while simultaneously entrenching oppression. But the same is true, this matter of ambivalence, of the other two terms as well. Deregulation of markets does indeed have the negative effects Polanyi stressed, but it can also beget positive effects to the extent that the protections it disintegrates are oppressive. Nor is emancipation immune to an analogous ambivalence, as it produces not only liberation, but also social strains that complicate efforts to build political coalitions that are sufficiently broad to overcome corporate power and effectively protect people and nature from corporate predation. This last point concerning the ambivalence of emancipation will be front and center here. In what follows, I examine three recent movements for emancipation, each of which disclosed and criticized an oppressive dimension of social protection in the democratic welfare states of the post-war period. Often, these movements saw themselves as locked in a two-sided struggle, focused on opposing predatory protections. They were not always sufficiently aware of the triple movement's third prong, namely efforts to deregulate markets. Neglecting the rise of neoliberalism, these movements misunderstood their situation and misjudged the likely consequences of their actions. The result of their failure to mediate the conflict between emancipation and social protection with reference to marketization is shaping the course of capitalist crisis to all of our detriments. That, in any case, is the thesis I shall argue here. Now, my argument proceeds as follows. First, I want to consider some social institutional implications of the triple movement. Then, I want to analyze the respective ambivalences of second-wave feminism, multiculturalism, and anti-imperialism. In each case, I will consider how a struggle for emancipation from oppressive social protections could benefit from the figure of the triple movement. So let me spell out some of the social institutional presuppositions of the triple movement in contrast to those of Polanyi's double movement. As I noted yesterday, at one level, Polanyi assumed a fundamental binary distinction between society and economy. That distinction underlay his view of an epical struggle between marketizers who sought to disencumber economy from society and protectionists who sought to subordinate economy to society. Yet, of course, as I have already noted, Polanyi also introduced a third major institutional term in that epical struggle turned largely on the control of state power. It turned out, despite their insistence on the naturalness of the self-regulating market, that marketizers could only advance their project by capturing and deploying state power. They needed the state both to disable the non-economic regulations that had previously embedded markets and to impose the rule of supply and demand on populations that were often resistant. Likewise, protectionists could only hope to re-embed markets by capturing and deploying state power. Only by recourse to the latter's capacities could they devise and enforce regulations that would subject production and exchange to moral and ethical norms. For both sides, then, the state was essential. And so the logic of Polanyi's argument entailed a triad of social institutions: society, economy, state. Now, on further reflection, however, this triad appears to be not fully adequate to the embedding-disembedding problematic once we take into account emancipation. In fact, the embedding of markets can only be a joint product of state and society. Before laissez-faire, mercantilist states worked in tandem with non-state institutions, such as the church and the family, from which they drew the cultural meanings and ethical norms they used to shape and legitimate their regulatory regimes. The same is true for the democratic welfare states of embedded liberalism. The protections they instituted, too, were fashioned in part from meanings and norms that were already widely diffused throughout society. In fact, cultural meanings and norms constitute the indispensable symbolic stuff of all embedding. States cannot create this symbolic stuff out of whole cloth. They rely, rather, on pre-existing meanings and norms to meet them halfway. That's a Habermasian formulation. Therein lies the rub. Historically, as I noted yesterday, the meanings and norms that have served to embed markets have often been hierarchical and exclusionary. When institutionalized, they have stamped the arrangements that Polanyi thought protected society as oppressive. What these arrangements protected was not society simpliciter, but hierarchical exclusionary society. They protected some people at the expense of others. Premised on oppressive norms, they entrenched disparities in social status, political voice, and access to resources. The effect was to prevent some people from participating fully on a par with others in social life. And that, in turn, inspired struggles for emancipation from oppressive protections. Now, it was in part to validate struggles for emancipation that I proposed in yesterday's lecture to transform Polanyi's double movement into a triple movement. But that revision entails another significant modification, in this case to Polanyi's institutional framework. Specifically, it entails the introduction of a fourth term above and beyond the triad of society, economy, and state. The fourth term is the public sphere of civil society, understood as a space of public contestations over entrenched norms. The public sphere of civil society is the arena in which movements for emancipation mobilize. It's the communicative space in which they publicly scrutinize the norms that inform protections. It is also the space in which those who defend entrenched protections are forced to respond to their critics. It is the space, therefore, in which the tacitly diffused common sense of society is transformed into explicitly avowed propositional positions, subject to critique on the one hand and to explicit defense on the other. Now, it's through the give and take among such opposing perspectives that emancipation can, under propitious conditions, become a social force. When it is understood this way, as a contestatory communicative space, the public sphere of civil society appears as the seedbed of emancipation. By introducing emancipation, therefore, the perspective of the triple movement requires that the category of civil society be introduced as well. The effect is to transform Polanyi's triad of society, economy, and state into a quartet, which also includes the public sphere of civil society. The further effect is to alter the valence of his first term, society, which is now contrasted with civil publicity. Whereas the latter operates in the modality of contestation, the former operates in the modality of doxa. Thus, the public sphere of civil society is a testing ground through which the norms infusing social protection may be forced to pass. A kind of purifying fire, it affords the chance to subject those norms to critical scrutiny from the standpoint of emancipation. As such, the public sphere of civil society can be a medium for delegitimating established social protections. The results can point in either of two directions. Delegitimation can foster deregulation on the one hand, or transformation of the mode of production. Protection. Mode of production. Whoa, that's a hell of a slip. Some old spirit is hovering above me. The mode of protection on the other. It is because both of those outcomes are possible that the public sphere of civil society appears as the institutional basis and ground of emancipation's ambivalence. But the introduction of civil society also complicates the view of the state. State regulation can be characterized in terms of its relation to civil society. In one scenario, social protections can be administered in a top-down, étatiste fashion, treated as the province of experts and severed from the communicative processes of civil society. In another, they can be administered in a participatory democratic fashion, as permeable to and in ongoing dialogue with civil society actors. As a space of contestation, moreover, the public sphere of civil society affords the possibility of what I call meta-political critique. Such critique is not directed at the political dynamics internal to a bounded political community whose membership is treated as a given. It is addressed, rather, to the boundaries that delimit the polity and its circle of membership. Indeed, to the design of the broader political space in which bounded polities are situated. Such meta-political critique asks questions like the following. Are the boundaries and delimitations of bounded communities oppressive because misframed? Do they exclude from the circle of protection some whom markets expose to risk? Do they deny the status of membership to some on whose activities society relies? Often launched from transnational public spheres, metapolitical critique affords a level of reflexivity that is largely absent from Polanyi's thinking, but that can be increasingly observed in social reality. Witness the anti-imperialist and cosmopolitan struggles of over globalization in our own time. In general, then, the triple movement revises the social institutional structure of Polanyi's thought. The effect is to introduce three sets of questions that he overlooked. The first concerns the ethical meanings and norms that inform protections. Have these been publicly vetted, or do they still exist in the mode of doxa? Are they oppressive in the sense of violating the principle of participatory parity, or are they emancipatory in the sense of fostering such parity? A second set of questions concerns the modality of state regulation. Is protection organized in a bureaucratic, étatiste manner, which disempowers its beneficiaries, whom it treats less as active citizens than as passive consumers? Or is it organized in a participatory democratic manner as a mode of active citizenship? A third set of questions concerns the metapolitical framing of social protections. Is state regulation misframed in the sense that it rests on a mismatch between the scope of protection on the one hand and that of exposure to the danger of markets on the other? Or is regulation well-framed, affording protection to all who are exposed and to all on whose activities society relies? Such questions are by no means a monopoly of critical theory. On the contrary, they have been raised, indeed are being raised, by emancipatory social movements of various stripes. In the era of embedded liberalism, such movements challenged the oppressive aspects of social protection in welfare states. Among the many movements that could be cited here, I will concentrate on three in particular, as I already said: feminism, multiculturalism, and anti-imperialism. You will see that I've sort of already introduced some of the conceptual work needed to discuss the New Left critique of bureaucratic protection, but I won't have a chance to consider that here. Now, each of these movements identified a specific sense in which the democratic welfare states of embedded liberalism were oppressive. As I argued yesterday, feminists exposed the oppressive character of social protections that were premised on gender-coded status hierarchies which disadvantage women. And anti-imperialists unmasked the oppressive character on social protections that were premised on the gerrymandering of political space, which wrongly excluded ex-colonial peoples from any possibility of protection. Much more recently, as I'll argue today, multiculturalists have disclosed the oppressive character of social protections that are premised on majority religious or majority ethnocultural self-understandings, which penalize members of minority groups. In each case, the movement in question disclosed a type of oppression and raised a corresponding claim for emancipation. In each case, however, the movement's claims for emancipation proved ambivalent. Seen through the lens of the triple movement, the claims could line up in principle either with marketization or with social protection. In the first case, where emancipation aligned with marketization, it would serve to erode not just the oppressive dimension, but social protection simpliciter. In the second case, where emancipation aligned with social protection, it would serve not to erode, but rather to transform the mode of protection, which I'm saying correctly. Okay, with a view to these ambivalent dynamics, let's now examine these three exemplary critiques of the post-war welfare state. So, the feminist critique targeted the gender hierarchical character of social protection. In the United States, this meant exposing the gender subtext of a system divided into stigmatized poor relief for women and children on the one hand, and respectable social insurance for those constructed as workers on the other. In this system, feminists discerned traces of an older schema inherited from before the war, indeed from long ago, known as the family wage. That schema envisioned the ideal typical citizen as a breadwinner and a family man whose wage was the principal, if not the sole, economic support of his family, and whose wife's wages, if any, were merely supplemental. Deeply gendered, this family wage ideal supplied a central portion of the ethical substance on which states drew to re-embed markets. Normalizing women's dependency, the resulting system of social protections compromised women's chances to participate fully on a par with men in social life. Institutionalizing androcentric understandings of family and of work, it naturalized gender hierarchy and removed it from political contestation. Equally important, by valorizing waged work, embedded liberalism's mode of protection obscured the social importance of unwaged care work. Now, such was the feminist critique of post-war social democracy. Politically and intellectually powerful, this critique was nonetheless ambivalent, capable of leading in either of two directions. Taken one way, the critique of the family wage would aim to secure women's full access to employment and to employment-linked entitlements on a par with men. In that case, it would tend to valorize wage labor and the androcentric ideal of individual independence, effectively devaluing unwaged care work, interdependence, and solidarity. Targeting the traditional gender ethos that was still serving to embed markets, a feminism of this sort could end up furthering their disembedding. Intentional or not, the effect could be to align the struggle against gender hierarchy with marketization. In principle, however, the feminist critique of oppressive protection could develop in another way. Differently articulated, it could align with the other pole of the triple movement, namely the pole of social protection. In the second scenario, the thrust of feminist critique would be to reject androcentric valuations, especially the overvaluation of waged labor and the undervaluation of unwaged care work. Casting care work as a matter of public importance, the movement's thrust would be to re-envision social arrangements in a way that enabled everyone, male or female, to perform both sets of activities without the strains that beset all such efforts today. Rejecting, too, the gender-coded opposition between dependence and independence, a pro-protectionist feminism would serve to break the spurious link between social hierarchy on the one hand and the dependency that is a universal feature of the human condition on the other. Valorizing solidarity and interdependence, the critique would work not to dissolve, but to transform social protections. Now, as a matter of fact, second wave feminism encompassed both orientations. For the most part, the so-called liberal and radical feminists gravitated in the direction of marketization, while socialist feminists and feminists of color were more likely to align with forces for social protection. In the first case, the alignment was not always intended. Certainly not all liberal and radical feminists consciously aimed to promote marketization. But by failing to situate their struggle for emancipation in the context of the triple movement, they could end up nevertheless furthering disembedding and deregulation. I have to say that in the other case, by contrast, the alignment was relatively conscious. Feminists whose concern dovetailed with protectionist forces tend to have an intuitive grasp of the logic of the triple movement. They were often aware that their struggle for emancipation intersected with another struggle between protection and deregulation. Positioning themselves in a three-sided game, they sought to avoid abetting the forces of deregulation, even while vigorously opposing oppressive protections. Arguably, the feminist ambivalence has been resolved in recent years in favor of marketization. Insufficiently attuned to the rise of the new market fundamentalism, mainstream feminists have ended up supplying the rationale for a new mode of capital accumulation, heavily dependent on women's wage labor. As women of every class, ethnicity, and nationality have poured into labor markets throughout the globe, the ideology of the family wage is being replaced by the newer, more modern norm of the two-earner family. Never mind that the reality that underlies this new ideal is depressed wage levels, decreased job security, declining living standards, a steep rise in the number of hours worked for wages per household, exacerbation of the double shift, and a rise in female-headed households. Neoliberal ideology turns a sow's ear into a silk purse by appropriating the feminist critique of the family wage. That critique now supplies a good part of the romance that invests the new flexible capitalism with a higher meaning and a moral point. Endowing their struggles with an ethical meaning, the feminist romance attracts women at both ends of the spectrum. At one end, the female cadres of the professional middle class, determined to crack the glass ceiling. At the other end, the female temps, part-timers, low-wage service workers, domestic sex workers, migrants, EPZ workers, and microcredit borrowers, seeking not only income and material security, but also dignity, self-betterment, and liberation from traditional authority. At both ends of the spectrum, the dream of women's emancipation is harnessed to the engine of capital accumulation. Thus, feminism's critique of the family wage has assumed a marketizing valence. Once capable of aligning with social protection, it serves increasingly today to intensify neoliberalism's valorization of waged labor. Absorbed in opposing predatory protections, mainstream feminism has become entangled in a dangerous liaison with neoliberalism. Now, more recently, multiculturalists criticized another oppressive dimension of social protection in the post-war era. The oppressions of interest to them arose from the discriminatory character of the national ethical substance that permeated the social policies of welfare states. That substance was an exclusionary monocultural national ethos, which infused social democratic entitlements in embedded liberalism to the detriment and disadvantage of minorities. Examining the design of public space in post-war welfare states, multiculturalists found majority religious and majority national self-understandings, which prevented minorities from participating fully on a par with others in social life. They espied, in other words, a crypto-majority communitarianism, even in countries with an avowedly liberal or republican self-understanding. Treating the majority ethos, which is actually particular, as if it were neutral and universal, those countries' social protections penalized minorities, not unlike those of their overtly communitarian counterparts. For multiculturalists, tacit or overt majority communitarianism can be found in a broad range of social policies in post-war states. Especially propitious host environments include educational policy, family law, public holidays, work scheduling practices, work uniforms and dress codes, and language policy. By extension, however, the argument applies as well to the built environment, which critics contend encodes non-neutral discriminatory understandings of able-bodiedness. The effect in all such cases is to create asymmetrical burdens for minorities, whether the minorities are religious, linguistic, national, ethnic, or those defined as disabled. In each case, the affected minority members are prevented from participating on a par with others in social interactions. What the majority may experience as a welcome shield from the effects of unregulated markets is lived by members of minorities as a badge of inferiority and a token of second-class citizens. Such protections, again, are oppressive because they penalize and so disrespect members of minorities. Now, that's the multiculturalist critique of the oppressive dimension of social protection in embedded liberalism. This critique, too, is ambivalent, susceptible of at least two different political articulations. Insofar as they target an exclusionary, monistic cultural nationalism, multicultural claims could dissolve a major element of the solidary ethical substance that has served to embed markets and to legitimate their political regulation. Articulated in that way, multicultural struggles for emancipation could work to desolidarize the citizenry, eroding support for social protection and advancing the disembedding of markets. In that case, they would be allied with marketization. Taken in another direction, however, the effect could be quite different. In the second scenario, multiculturalism could serve to replace restrictive, pre-political, ethnicized forms of solidarity with a more broadly inclusive, political, communicatively generated solidarity, and thus to reconstruct on a more adequate basis the self-understandings of democratic polities. In that case, multiculturalism would serve to modernize the ethical substance available for embedding markets and for legitimating their political regulation. Allied with social protection against marketization, this sort of multiculturalism, again, would not dismantle, but rather transform the mode of protection. Now, as a matter of fact, multiculturalism, too, is internally divided. Within its ranks, one can discern both marketizing and protectionist currents. One variant, effectively allied with marketization, views cultural markers as akin to commodities, fungible, shallow dressings to be worn and discarded at will. Deeply consumerist, multiculturalism of this sort is often preoccupied with the superficial trappings of esteem while failing to focus on the deeper structural asymmetries of power and respect. It is at best oblivious to, at worst complicit with, marketization. Other currents allied with protection are also problematic. Separatist variants are more interested in protecting allegedly pristine group specificity than on interacting on terms of parity with others. Their view of culture is deeply essentialist, often serving to buttress identities constructed as patriarchal, homophobic, and difference hostile. So that leaves the more genuinely emancipatory currents of multiculturalism, democratic, anti-essentialist, pluralist, committed to parity of participation for all. But even these can become problematic when they misinterpret their situation as a simple two-sided conflict with oppressive protections. In that case, they neglect the mediating third and can wind up facilitating marketization. Arguably, this is in fact what has happened in recent years. Even the best currents of multiculturalism have been so absorbed in the culture wars that they have ignored a tectonic shift in the broader landscape. Bent on criticizing oppressive protections, they failed to notice that the state-organized capitalism of embedded liberalism had morphed into neoliberalism. But of course, context changes all. A critique that was unambiguously emancipatory in the heyday of social democracy assumes a different, more problematic valence when protection per se is under sustained assault by free marketeers. Under these conditions, even a scrupulously democratic, anti-essentialist multiculturalism can end up unwittingly abetting deregulation if it fails to situate itself in the three-sided conflict zone of the triple movement. Incorporated into compromise formations like the Third Way, which, by the way, in my view, is precisely a kind of amalgam of progressive multiculturalist emancipation with, you know, at least quasi-neoliberal economics. So incorporated into compromise formations like the Third Way, multiculturalism, too, has become entangled in a dangerous liaison with neoliberalism. Now, how am I doing on time as far as I have 15 minutes? Can I take? Okay, in that case, I'll continue. Now, thirdly, anti-imperialists also criticized the social protections of the post-war era. In their view, these were oppressive because misframed, premised on a Westphalian mapping of political space that had been superimposed upon transnational and global markets. The result was a mismatch between the scope of the national scope of protection on the one hand and the transnational scope of exposure on the other. For the anti-imperialists, this mismatch was indeed constitutive of embedded liberalism, which sought, and I'm relying on John Ruggie's account of it, which sought to combine international free trade with domestic Keynesian state steering. The combination proved deeply oppressive in a world still marked by colonial asymmetries of power and wealth. Against that background, the post-World War II world system enabled more or less robust regimes of social protection in the wealthy states of the core, while disenabling comparable protections in the periphery. Undeniably emancipatory, decolonization could not by itself transform the underlying power dynamics. Through such mechanisms as third world debt and first world agricultural subsidies, the former colonial powers financed their domestic protections through the fruits of unequal exchange with former colonies. So one side's protection was still the other's predation. Such was the anti-imperialist critique that flourished in the post-independence era. Like the feminist critique just discussed, this one also harbored several distinguishable variants. One variant pointed toward a perfected Westphalianism, in which postcolonial states would dispose of the same capacities to protect their population as did their former colonial masters. Another pointed toward a post-Westphalian order in which social protections would be institutionalized trans-territorially by transnational or global powers, serving all exposed to danger by transnational or global markets. Meanwhile, of course, one should not forget the cultural nationalist currents which sought to embed post-colonial markets in ethical frameworks derived from revived or invented national traditions, which were also patriarchal, homophobic, and unjust to minorities. So, of course, in their case, the struggle against imperialist oppression along one axis, became allied with oppression on other axes. So anti-imperialism, too, was ambivalent. Currents focused exclusively on opposing the imperialist dimension of embedded liberalism could wind up abetting, for example, gender oppression, an alignment they sometimes embraced with unabashed pleasure. Conversely, currents seeking cosmopolitan humanist alternatives to nationalist misframing could unwittingly find themselves in bed with neoliberals who yearned for the flat, open, frictionless space of the global market. Alternatively, the anti-imperialist critique could point to, Shayla Ben-Habib's phrase, another cosmopolitanism aimed at replacing one-size-fits-all nationalism with a multi-level, multi-scalar framework of politics and law premised on post-Westphalian principles of belonging. In that case, the thrust would be to create new post-Westphalian public powers capable of cross-border market regulation and social protection. As the 20th century wore on, however, the ambivalence of anti-imperialism has been largely resolved in favor of marketization. With the fall of communism, Marxist-inspired variants ceded pride of place to transnational political theologies, hardly disposed to link protection with emancipation. So formations like political Islam and others offer a bifurcated vision combining supply-side economics with authoritarian and hierarchical regimes of protection. Playing the three-sided game, they mobilize protection and marketization against emancipation. Well, what should we conclude from this account of predatory protections and dangerous liaisons? Certainly not that second-wave feminism, multiculturalism, and anti-imperialism have failed simpliciter, nor that they are to blame for the triumph of neoliberalism. Surely not that strategies for emancipation are inherently problematic, nor that emancipatory ideals are always already doomed to be recuperated for marketizing projects. I conclude, rather, that those for whom emancipation is above all a struggle for parity of participation need to become much more historically self-aware as we operate on a terrain that is also populated by our neoliberal double. Let me return to the larger questions that have inspired these lectures. Reflecting on the great transformation we are living through now, I have in effect rewritten Polanyi's project. By theorizing the double movement, he portrayed the conflicts of his time as an epical battle for the soul of the market. As I said yesterday, will nature, labor, and money be stripped of all ethical meaning, sliced, diced, and traded like widgets, and to hell with the consequences? Or will markets in those fundamental bases of human society be subject to ethically and morally informed political regulation? Now, that battle remains as pressing as ever in the 21st century. In yesterday's lecture, however, I suggested that Polanyi's battle for the soul of the market was cross-cut by another major battle of epical significance, a battle for the soul of social protection. Will the arrangements that re-embed markets in the post-neoliberal era we anticipate be hierarchical or egalitarian, misframed or well-framed, difference hostile or difference friendly? That battle, too, remains as pressing as ever. In today's lecture, however, I have suggested that both it and Polanyi's battle are cross-cut by yet a third one, a battle for the soul of emancipation. Will the emancipatory struggles of the 21st century serve to advance the disembedding and deregulation of markets? Or will they serve to democratize and to make just social protection? Winning that battle, I think, is key to winning the others. But it requires that movements for emancipation end their dangerous liaison with neoliberalism and forge a principled alliance with social protection. In hopes of advancing this agenda, I want to conclude by suggesting that the current crisis of neoliberalism offers a chance to reorient emancipatory struggles away from their dangerous liaisons with marketization. First, the crisis of neoliberalism offers the chance to resolve the feminist ambivalence in favor of social protection. What this means is breaking the spurious link between the feminist critique of the family wage and flexible capitalism. Reclaiming the critique of androcentrism, feminists might militate now for a form of life that decenters waged work, in part by shortening the workweek, and that protects and supports uncommodified activities, including, but not only, care work. Second, the crisis of neoliberalism offers the chance to resolve multiculturalism's ambivalence in favor of social protection. This means breaking the spurious link between multiculturalism and desolidarization, reclaiming the effort to reconstruct the self-understandings, the broad self-understandings, not the sectional self-understandings, of democratic polities, we might try to modernize the ethical substance available for embedding markets and for legitimating their political regulation. Finally, the crisis of neoliberalism offers the chance to resolve anti-imperialism's long-standing ambivalence about the Westphalian frame in favor of post-Westphalian regimes of social protection. Given capital's transnational reach, the protective capacities needed today cannot be lodged solely in the territorial state. Here, accordingly, the task is to break the exclusive identification of social protection with the bounded political community. Thus, anti-imperialists and cosmopolitans might militate now for a new post-Westphalian order of social regulation, democratic, multi-scalar, and attuned to dangers posed to all by global and transnational markets. I am suggesting, then, that this is a moment in which emancipatory movements should think big. Having watched the neoliberal onslaught instrumentalize our best ideas, we may have an opening now in which to reclaim them. In seizing this moment, we might just bend the arc of the impending great transformation toward a new alliance between emancipation and social protection. Thank you.